Chapter 39 Max and Frank. Gallipoli, Turkey, August 1915. Max holds the binoculars up to his eyes and scans the swathe of Suvla Beach, which just 2 days before had been as empty and peaceful as the beaches at Dupin in Belgium he had visited in his childhood. Now the beach is teeming with British and Australian troops, unloading crates of supplies and pitching tents. A huge armoured ship is anchored only a few metres from the beach, disgorging yet more soldiers down wide metal ramps that run directly up to the sand. "Let me see," Fritz says, as he crawls up to join Max at the top of the ridge. Max hands him the binoculars. "I hope Lieutenant Colonel Kimmel's reinforcements arrive soon. Major Vilma said we have no hope of holding off all these battalions with only 1,500 men and no machine guns. They've already taken the two small hills beyond the Salt Lake. We can't let them get up to the higher ridge." Fritz glances over to a high ridge to his left. "They'll definitely go for the Sari Bear Ridge. If they get up there, they'll surround our trenches at Anzac Beach." "Exactly." Max shuffles down the sandy hill to the goat track that winds along the ridge. "Hurry, Fritz. I need to tell Major Vilma what we've seen." "Jawohl, Lieutenant Fischer." Fritz salutes Max. Then he digs his heels into the hill and propels himself onto the goat track. "Why do you suppose they haven't made me a lieutenant yet?" "That's easy, Fritz," Max says, as he loops the binoculars around his neck. "Would you want to be commanded by you?" "Very funny." "You know as well as I do. It's because you failed your officer exams." They head through the marsh grass and windswept pines, back to their battalion on the far side of Sari Bear. "You have to learn to apply yourself. At least there are no girls here to distract you, Fritz." "So that's your secret. No English girlfriend to distract you. You'll be a major before you know it, because you're never going to see her again." Max yanks the sleeve of Fritz's uniform. "What do you mean by that?" Fritz pulls his arm away from Max's grip. "Seriously? You're a German officer now. You'd be shot as a traitor or a spy if you ever got in touch with her. She's an enemy." "Don't ever speak like that about Celia again. Do you understand me?" "I'm just saying the facts." Max steps close to Fritz until he is staring straight into his friend's startled grey gaze. "Do you understand me, Corporal?" "Yes. Okay." "Good." Max turns away abruptly and heads down the hill. He glances over his shoulder at Fritz's lanky frame in the too large uniform. "Hurry up, Corporal. What are you waiting for?" Frank looks up from his perch in the sand in the shade of a dune. He is safe here from the snipers and the shrapnel, from the sporadic shells being lobbed onto the beach by the Turks. He'd seen more than his share of men cut down by bullets and shrapnel in France. You would have thought you'd get used to it, but you never do. He hears a shout and watches a horde of bantering men, some of them looking no older than 15, if a day, splash in the turquoise water of the bay, their bodies glistening with a wet sheen as they toss around a cork buoy like a football. Out in the bay, the HMS Jonquil sits at anchor, the elderly General Stopford still having not set foot on the beach after having slept through the initial attack on the smaller hills the previous day. Frank chews his lip as his pencil hovers over the sheet of writing paper. They should be up on the ridge, taking advantage of the sparse opposition. By now, the Turks and the Germans knew they were in the bay. They wouldn't waste any time sending reinforcements. Any idiot could see that. Instead, his sergeant had said they were under Stopford's orders to consolidate their position. He scans the high ridge surrounding the bay like a huge horseshoe. Sitting ducks, that's what they were. They'd lost their chance at an easy run up to the ridge. He wets his lips with a dribble of water from his canteen. There's another problem. 20,000 men, and barely enough water for half of them. Somebody somewhere had forgotten that August in the Mediterranean is a bloody furnace. He wipes at his dripping forehead and sinks further back into the shade of the dune. He props the sheet on his knee and taps at it with his pencil. He may as well write to her, even though he knows it's a lost cause. She's never given him any reason to hope. Still, he has nothing to lose. Somewhere in Turkey. August the 8th, 1915. Dear Miss Fry, I'm sitting on a beach on a very hot summer day, somewhere in Turkey. I can't say where we are, though truthfully I'm not sure I could find it on a map if I were asked. Still, it's better than sitting in the mud in a French trench, so for that I am thankful. I also wanted to thank you very much for visiting me when I was laid up in hospital in London this spring. Your visit was like a breath of fresh air, and you were very kind to let me beat you at Hearts. I must insist on a rematch when I am back in London, and I shall expect you not to restrain yourself. I should be quite honoured to be trounced in Hearts by Miss Cecilia Fry. I hope you and your family are keeping well. Please give my kindest regards to them all, and to your sister Jessie especially, for her sterling care of me when I was in hospital. I am feeling very much better. Yours faithfully, Frank Jeffries. Max shuts his right eye and peers down the barrel of his rifle. Below his battalion, on the summit of Scimitar Hill, at the foot of the Sari Bear Ridge, mist and smoke rise from the salt lake and scrubby terrain that separates the beach from the ridge. The shrapnel has set the tinder dry grass burning, and the smoke blends with the salt lake's evaporating water in a dense cloud that sits over Suvla Bay like the steam from a boiling pot. Emerging from the fog like spectres in a bad dream, shadowy shapes of men run blindly toward the foot of the hill. He aims for one of the dark forms and pulls the trigger. The figure twitches and falls backward into the embrace of the dense cloud. Good shot, Max. Pay attention, Fritz. It's like picking off ducks on a pond. There's no sport in this. What's happened to the machine guns? They're sending them down the line. Kimmel's brought them in. Max adjusts his elbows on the rocky ground behind the sandbag barricade and aims for another dark form. It's not a sport. It's war. He shoots, but the figure simply spins around and clutches its arm. Another shot rings out, and the figure sinks into the smoking grass. Fritz pumps the air with his bald fist. Bullseye! Another stinking Tommy hits the dust. Max glances sideways at his friend. Don't get cocky. There's no fun in this at all, Max. Fritz glances behind him. I'm going over. What? No, stop, Fritz. Fritz, it's an order. But Fritz is already over the sandbags and sliding down through the rocks and scrubby earth. Stupid idiot. Max hesitates for an instant. Then he climbs over the top of the sandbags and follows Fritz into the cloud. Frank Jeffries stumbles up the hill, coughing as the smoke settles in his damaged lungs. He holds his primed rifle at the ready. Every now and then he catches his foot on a rock or a charred bush, or worse, the smoking uniform of a dead soldier. He presses on through the fog, the moans and cries of injured men drowned out by the barrage of shells and bullets. Mother of God! Mother of God! Holy Jesus! Mother of God! Soon he is in a rhythm. Mother of God! Mother of God! Holy Jesus! Mother of God! A figure crashes out of the smoke in front of him. In the next second, he sees the spike on the soldier's helmet, the bayoneted rifle. He pulls the trigger. The soldier collapses at his feet. He steps over him and hurries up the hill through the smoke. Chapter 40. Jessie, HMHS Letitia, Gallipoli, Turkey, August 1915. Ivy Roach dips behind a steel strut on the HMHS Letitia's deck as a shell explodes in the sea about 30 metres away, sending a spout of water over the prow of a nearby barge of wounded soldiers. Blinkin' hell, that was close. Can't they see the crosses on the sides of the ship? They're not aiming at us. Jessie scours the dark waters of the bay for the long, flat shapes of the barges being towed out to the hospital ship by small, sturdy trawlers. They're aiming at the barges of wounded. We're lucky there's no moon tonight. It's harder for the Turks to find them. And more likely they'll hit us, Ivy tuts. Those poor blokes. As if they haven't been through enough already. I've managed to count 17 barges so far. Jessie nudges Ivy's arm. Come on, let's get downstairs. It looks like we're going to have a busy night. Ivy hurries after Jessie down the narrow staircase to the hospital ward. Rows of beds, neatly made up with bleached sheets and pillows, are crammed along the grey metal walls. Nurses and Egyptian orderlies fly in and out of the ward, carrying supplies and bandages in preparation for the first arrivals. I'd best get to the operating theatre, Ivy. We'll need to get as many boys patched up for the journey to the hospitals on Lemnos as we can. Righto, I'll be needing some of your lice out later. I can't bear the lice. I think the lice are winning that war. Jessie pushes aside the curtain over the door to one of the four storerooms which have been converted into operating theatres. A white-masked anaesthetist sits at the head of the operating table, and an orderly stands beside the two equipment trolleys. Jessie quickly washes at the sink and pulls on a pair of rubber gloves. Hurry up! In here! A surgeon pulls aside the curtain, and two orderlies barge into the room carrying a groaning soldier on a stretcher. Get him onto the table! Quickly! Jessie looks over at the surgeon, who has the black hair and dark skin of an Egyptian. The surgeon addresses an anaesthetist as he pushes past the orderlies. Get him under, sister. Clean him up while I get ready. His voice carries the rolling accent of the orderlies, though unlike the majority of them, his English is fluent. Shrapnel, pick out what you can with the tweezers. Jessie's eyes widen. Pick out the shrapnel? I've never done... The doctor glares at her as he lathers his hands at the sink. Then find me a nurse who can. No, no, I'll do it. She turns to the orderly and points to the scissors. Cut his jacket off, please. She leans over the soldier, a young British infantryman with a shock of ginger hair and green eyes glazed with pain and fear, and smiles at him reassuringly. Don't worry. We'll have you right as rain before you know it. The soldier clutches her hands.
Please, I don't want to die. I want to see my mum. I don't want to die. I want to go home.
Jessie eyes the wound that gapes like a mouth spewing blood across the soldier's belly. She swallows. You'll be fine. I promise. The anaesthetist drips chloroform over the gauze mask he holds over the soldier's face. The soldier's eyes roll back, and his grip relaxes. Jessie takes a glass bottle of Dakin's solution from the trolley and points to the rubber tube that is curled like a snake amongst the bandages. Hand me the hose, please. She twists the cap off the Dakin's solution and gives the orderly the bottle. She makes a pouring gesture. Pour it into the hose slowly, while I wash out the wound. Jessie holds the end of the hose over the wound and splashes the antiseptic solution into the deepest recesses, exposing black shards of shrapnel that stick out of the shredded pink flesh like broken black eggshells. She hands the tube back to the orderly. Continue, please. She picks up the tweezers and squints at a long black splinter. Grasping it, she carefully pulls it free. Jessie peels off the rubber gloves and drops them into the sanitary bin for sterilising. She picks up the yellow soap and lathers her hands over the portable sink. Her limbs feel as heavy as lead, and a dull ache spreads behind her forehead. She has lost count of the soldiers with their gaping shrapnel wounds, their faces burnt beyond recognition, their arms and legs riddled with bullet wounds. Surely there has to be an end to it. The surgeon joins her at the sink. "Soap, please, sister." "Excuse me, Lieutenant."
"Sister is fine."
Jessie hands him the soap. "No one calls us Lieutenant."
"I shall call you Lieutenant. We are at war, and you are an army nurse."
They stand beside each other in silence as they soap their hands and arms. Jessie feels her cheeks redden. Why does he look at her like he's judging her every action and finding her wanting? She thrusts her hands into the sink at the same moment he does. She pulls away as if she's been burnt, water splashing over his surgical gown.
"I'm terribly sorry, Captain."
He looks at her with a gaze so intense that it is like being pierced by an arrow. He gestures to the sink.
"After you."
The curtain flaps open, and two orderlies enter with another stretcher.
"Shazar?"
the doctor asks in Arabic. The older orderly shakes his head and says something she doesn't understand. The surgeon looks at Jessie.
"We may be here for some time. He has a bullet wound near his heart. He is lucky he is still alive."
Jessie quickly rinses off the soap and dries her hands. She pulls on a fresh pair of rubber gloves and watches the orderly cut away the uniform. A German uniform.
"Lieutenant, irrigate, please."
But she is rooted to the spot, as surely as if she were a tree, with roots reaching down through the floor to twine around the engine room's ovens below.
"Quickly!" He's German."
"What is that to us? He is a man, and he is wounded. It is our duty to help. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir, but..."
The surgeon's voice hardens.
"Irrigate the wound, Lieutenant. That is an order."
"Yes, Captain."
She lifts off the makeshift bandage, which is saturated with the man's blood. Picking up the bottle of Dakin's solution, she pours it into the wound. Jessie tugs at the sleeve of Ivy's uniform.
"Where are you going with that pillow? Not that German again."
Ivy raises her eyebrows.
"He's finding it difficult to breathe, Jessie. Poor fella's not going to last the night. It's the least I can do."
"You seem to be going out of your way to help him."
"Jessie, he's a patient. I wouldn't care if he were the Kaiser himself. Where's your humanity?"
"I save it for our soldiers."
"Then you shouldn't be a nurse."
"I'll have you know I was top of the class in the surgical rotation and anatomy."
"Well, bully for you.
When you find your heart, let me know."
The soldier coughs and gasps for breath. He reaches to catch hold of Ivy's apron as she slides the pillow under his head.
"Wasser, bitte, please, water."
Ivy pours a glass of water and holds it to his mouth when the coughing subsides. He drinks as if he has been lost in a desert for days.
"Thank you."
He wipes his hand across his streaming forehead.
"I am so hot. Please, can you take off the sheet?"
"Of course."
She folds back the sheet to the foot of the steel-framed bed. She looks up at him to find him staring at her with his clear blue eyes.
"Yes? Is there something else?"
"I had a letter in my jacket."
"I'm afraid that will have been burnt. We had to cut it off you to operate."
Oh.
He swallows.
The letter. It's important.
He grasps Ivy's hand.
Please, can you see? Please.
His shoulders heave, and the coughing shakes his body. Ivy squeezes his hand.
I'll see if I can find it. I promise.
Ivy steps off the metal ladder into the heat and hissing noise of the ship's boiler room. A man shovels coal into one of the grates under a huge boiler, and she heads past the pipes and coal heaps towards him.
Excuse me, sir?
The stoker stands up and rests his elbow on the handle of his shovel. His pale eyes peer at her through a mask of grime.
So, is it? Do I look like the King of England? What you doing down here, love? You want my job? You can have it.
Thanks all the same, but I'll stick with what I know. You don't happen to know where the clothes that need to be burnt are? The ones from the soldiers?
The man points his thumb at the rear of the boiler room.
Down there! It's a bloody mountain!
He laughs and slaps his hand on the wooden handle of his shovel.
Bloody mountain! You hear that? That's a good one.
Thanks.
She finds the stack of filthy clothes wedged behind the far wall and the second boiler. Pulling on the rubber gloves she's stolen from the supply cupboard, she leans into her task.
Where is he?
Jessie looks up from the bed she is making. Where's who?
The German soldier.
You were right, Ivy. He didn't last the night.
One less to worry about.
Ivy stares at Jessie.
He was a person, Jessie. Caught up in this stupid war like the rest of us.
Jessie tosses the pillow onto the bed.
Why are you looking for him?
Ivy fingers the letter in her uniform pocket.
Just wanted to see if he needed anything. But it looks like I'm too late.
Chapter 41. Carlo. The Italian Front, August 1915. Carlo bends over his sketchbook and adds crosshatch shadows to the shaded side of the mountains he is sketching. Below him, the Isonzo River slides like a turquoise snake between the craggy, pine-covered mountains separating Italy from Austria-Hungary. But for the clamour of men's voices, the neighing of the supply horses, and the thuds of sandbags being stacked into defensive walls behind him, he could almost imagine a world without machine guns and heavy artillery, of bad food and thirst and death. He'd harboured no romantic illusions about the war when he'd signed up. At 32, he had seen more of the world than most, had loved more women than was his fair share, had earned and spent money without care. Except where Mariana was concerned. He'd always ensured his wife's medical bills were paid, though no amount of money seemed of any use to help bring her back from the dream world she inhabited. How a youthful indiscretion had changed the course of his life. A forced marriage at 19 to the wild and unstable Mariana Lodovisi, who had lost her last hold on the realities of this world after the birth of their son 13 years earlier. Aside from Paolo, God had bestowed one gift upon him. He could draw. And this gift had been his route to a small fame and modest wealth. As long as he could draw and paint, Mariana and Paolo would be well taken care of. But now, there is another family. He reaches into his pocket and takes out Etta's letter. His eyes travel across the familiar looping curls of her handwriting.
Adriana Christina, born the 30th of May. She has hair as golden as the sunrise and eyes as dark as chocolate. Truly, she is a gift of our love.
He draws Etta's fine features, her hazel eyes almost as green as olives, and the billowing luxury of her golden hair in his imagination.
His beautiful angel. His heart judders, and the exquisite pain of yearning grows within him. She is the true love of his heart, so joyful, with an infectious enthusiasm for life that he'd long thought he'd lost, but with her he has found once again. And now there is the child. How can he tell Etta he can never marry her while Marianna is alive? Marianna's Catholic family would never permit a divorce. And if he dies somewhere up in these mountains, what then? What of his beloved Etta and his little daughter then? He folds the cover of his sketchbook over the drawing. There is only one thing for it. He must stay alive. Chapter 42. Christina, Capri, Italy, July 1892. The day is fine. Another Caprese July day, like the previous one, and the day before that. Days with skies as blue as her mother's favourite delphiniums, turquoise seas rolling in the summer breeze, the air perfumed with spicy rosemary and lemons. Days that she had held inside of herself and unfurled in her mind's eye when the skies had darkened and life became bleak and hopeless in the dreadful month after Cecilia's birth. She lifts her face to the sun and shuts her eyes, willing the heat to penetrate through the leaden layers of her skin. The backs of her eyelids glow red and tears prick at her eyes. The tears come, a trickle at first, then a sudden surge, spewing from her eyes and down her sun-reddened cheeks, over her lips to her tongue. Salt, the only thing she can still taste. Cara mia, cara mia, don't cry, my darling girl. Stefania Albertini brushes Christina's auburn hair with her hand as the girl weeps into her shoulder. You must be strong, Tina. You are an innocenti, like your mother and like me. You must bury the pain deep inside yourself. What is done cannot be undone. You must move forward. You are not a girl any longer. You have someone else you must live for. You are a mother now. The whitewashed buildings, clustered along the shore, grow smaller, their inhabitants going about their lives on the island. Rolling out the dough for the thick ribbons of scialatielli pasta, arguing over the price of the fat shrimp or octopus in the market, climbing over the hills hunting rabbit to be slow-cooked in a terracotta pot with white wine, rosemary, garlic and herbs for Sunday lunch, as if nothing has changed. The ferry's wake churns a white V into the blue sea on its passage to Naples, setting the moored blue fishing boats bobbing on the waves, and the gulls dive and glide around the boat on the lookout for a titbit from a benevolent passenger. The baby stirs in Christina's arms, and a tiny arm frees itself from the swaddling. The pink hand balls and flexes, and Christina extends a finger. The tiny fingers, with their nails like mother-of-pearl, close around it. Stefania joins her beside the railing. She looks at the retreating limestone cliffs and green hills of Capri. You always have a home here, if you need, cara mia. She clears her throat and holds out her arms. Come, let me hold the baby, so I can always remember how she feels in my arms when you are both so far away in England. Part 4. 1916. Chapter 43. Jessie. Egypt, January 1916. Number 15, General Hospital, Alexandria, Egypt.
Jessie, over here.
Ivy waves at Jessie from her table in the hospital canteen. She wipes scone crumbs from her lips with her fingers.
Have you heard? Colonel James is organising a musical and dramatic society. There's a note posted on the canteen board. What do you fancy? Want to give it a go? I'm not much of a performer, Ivy. That's my sister Etta's forte. Oh, come on. How else are you going to get friendly with the doctors? Captain Delmage and Captain Dolan are going to be the musical coordinators, though I don't imagine that awful Captain Kellyard will be joining in. I've never met a grumpier man. He had a go at me the other day for forgetting to wash a soldier's feet. Like I don't have a million other things to think about. She follows Jessie into the hospital's bright, airy staff canteen. I have to be back in the ward in half an hour. Ivy grabs her plate from the table. Hold on, I want to get another scone. Jessie heads towards the lunch queue and collects a metal tray, followed by Ivy. So, Jessie, are you going to join the Dramatic Society? I didn't join the Queen Alexandra's to sing and dance or find a husband, Ivy. Ivy shrugs. I'm a red-blooded woman, aren't I? I know Matron has all these rules that we mustn't socialise with soldiers, but she hasn't said anything about doctors, has she? We're young, Jessie. Work hard, play hard. That's my motto. Look, I'm heading down to Cairo on Saturday with some Anzac nurses to show them the pyramids. You can be an honorary Aussie for the day. What do you say? All work and no play makes Jessie a dull girl. Jessie watches the server scoop spiced mutton stew onto a plate. Maybe. I haven't seen anything except the inside of the hospital and the nurse's residence since I arrived here. I could just as well be back in London. She takes the plate of food and sets it on her tray. Ivy pokes Jessie on the shoulder. Come on. Come to Cairo with us. It'll do you good. Oh, all right. I'll switch my shift with someone else. Ivy grabs a scone from a plate on the serving counter. Rightio, that's settled then. I'll give you some tips on how to ride a camel. What kind of tips? Basically, hang on for dear life and don't fall off. Jessie climbs the marble staircase up to the second floor, then up the narrow access staircase to the former school's flat concrete roof. She pushes open the wooden door and steps into the brilliant sunshine of the Egyptian winter day. A cool breeze wafts up the hill, where the three solid brick buildings of the former Abbasia Secondary School, now hastily converted into the No. 15 General Hospital, squat on the crest of the hill. She walks to the edge of the roof for the view of Alexandria spread out below the hill. Around the hospital buildings on their plain of dusty earth, Jessie counts 23 canvas tents which hold the overspill of wounded from the Gallipoli campaign. At the foot of the hill, the roofs of the ancient city's jigsaw buildings cluster together between alleyways and roads that wander through Alexandria like dirty streams. In the distance, the blue water of the Mediterranean glitters under the midday sun. The romance of the view, marred only by the hulking grey shapes of the naval destroyers, steaming east towards the military camps and hospitals of Port Said. She sits on the ledge and bites into an apple. You have washed that, I hope. She spits the apple into her hand. The tall figure of Captain Khalid stands in a corner, shaded by the doorway. Excuse me? You have washed the apple, I hope, he says, as he rolls up a small rug. You should peel it before you eat it. It may make you ill otherwise. Oh, I didn't know that. I only arrived in Alexandria a week ago. She looks at the mangled apple. I was looking forward to this. I haven't seen an apple since England. He tugs a handkerchief out of the pocket of his white medical coat and walks over to her. Wrap it in this so you can eat it later. His lips twitch under his black moustache when she hesitates. It is clean. Don't worry. Thank you. She wraps the handkerchief around the apple. Don't eat ice, either. He presses a hand against his chest as he inclines his head. Permit me to introduce myself. I am Captain Aziz Khalid, senior surgeon for the British Army in Egypt.
We've worked together on the Letitia at Gallipoli several times. I'm Lieutenant Jessica Fry.
I know.
He turns abruptly and heads towards the door. Shepherd's Hotel, Cairo, Egypt. The nurses dash up the steps to the canopied terrace of Shepherd's Hotel on Ibrahim Pasha Street, on the boundary of the European and Arab quarters of Cairo. To one side of the grand glass and wrought iron terrace, a military band in bright red jackets bangs out a spirited rendition of A Little Bit of What You Fancy Does You Good, under the shade of the towering palm trees. Ivy cranes her neck over the heads of the British and Anzac army officers, and immaculately dressed European women crowded into the terrace's wicker chairs.
There! Hurry, girls!
They shuffle past the crowded tables, apologising and giggling, as they bump against the chairs and flop into the seats.
There you go, ladies, Ivy says, as she waves her hand around the terrace. The best seats in Cairo. Everyone who's anyone comes here. Theda Bara, Anna Pavlova, kings and queens, and Anzac nurses.
A young red-haired nurse with a New Zealand accent pipes up to hurrahs from the others.
Right you are, Mabel.
A flush-faced young nurse named Nancy from Adelaide unpins her straw boater and fans her face.
I could kill a lemonade right now.
A soldier in the khaki uniform of an Australian light horse regiment leans back in his chair at a nearby table.
Is that an Aussie accent I'm hearing?
Nancy giggles.
It certainly is. I'm Nancy Evans from Adelaide.
Pleased to meet you, Nancy.
The soldier nods at his three companions, who all wear the light horse uniform.
We're from all over, Oz. Mick here is from... Where'd you say it was, Mick?
A blonde soldier with a broad, sunburnt face answers,
That'd be Wagga Wagga, mate. Righto, Mick there is from Wagga Wagga, Tommy Boy is from beautiful Brisbane, and Ralph over there is from Sydney.
He picks up a plumed hat from the table and tips it at the nurses.
Sergeant Archie Winter from Adelaide, at your service.
He winks at Nancy, who bursts into giggles. Jessie rolls her eyes and picks up a menu. Archie's blue eyes twinkle as he appraises her.
Whereabouts are you from, sister? You're a New Zealand girl, aren't you? I'll wager you're one of those serious types from Wellington.
I'm afraid you'd lose your wager. I'm English.
A white smile flashes in the young soldier's tanned face. There's always one bad apple.
Nancy erupts into another fit of giggles, earning her a sour glare from Jessie. She smiles at the waiter, who stands stiffly beside the table in a smart white jacket and red felt tarbouche, a starched white cloth folded neatly over his forearm.
We'll have four lemonades, please, Jessie says. Very cold, but no ice, if you would.
The waiter inclines his head and retrieves the menus from the nurses. Archie Winter tosses his hat onto the nurse's table.
Bring us four beers as well, will you, mate? Cheers.
As the waiter retreats through the grand entrance doors into the dark interior of the hotel, the four soldiers push their chairs around the nurse's table. Jessie watches the activity with growing annoyance. All she'd wanted was a nice day out with the other nurses, away from hospitals and war and soldiers. And here they are, swooped upon by a group of insolent Australians. Archie fixes his gaze on Jessie.
So, you're a Pommy, then?
I suppose I am a Pommy. I'm from London.
Long way from home, then, miss.
Aren't we all? Ivy prods Jessie's shoulder.
Jessie, lighten up. He's not gonna bite.
The soldier grins and holds out his hand.
Pleased to meet you, Jessie.
Jessie sighs and grasps his hand. The warmth of his skin travels through her fingers and up her arm, and she shivers involuntarily. Releasing his hand, she folds her arms.
She glances over at the hotel's entrance doors, willing the waiter to hurry up with the lemonades. The soldier chuckles.
That lemonade better be the best you've ever tasted.
What do you mean?
Because you seem more interested in lemonade than finding out all about this handsome young soldier from Adelaide.
Jessie bites her lip as she struggles to suppress a smile. What is she so worried about? Isn't this exactly what she's always wanted? To experience life in new places? Here she is, on the terrace of the famous Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo, Egypt, with a group of lively Australians and New Zealanders. She's a long way from Heather Green. She relaxes against the ridges of the wicker chair. What's the harm in enjoying the attention of a saucy young soldier? She rather likes his forwardness. It's a refreshing change from the few tongue-tied English boys who crossed her path in London. They'd mostly been interested in Etta, at any rate. Etta, the pretty sister, or Celie, the polite sister. Just like that Frank Jeffries. What sister is she? Jessie, the stubborn, ornery, difficult sister? Celie is Papa's favourite. Anyone can see that. And Mama indulges every silly wish of Etta's. Well, at least she did, until Etta ran away with the Italian. Knowing Etta, she'll come out of that smelling like roses, too. Whose favourite is she? No one's. She's no one's favourite. It doesn't matter. Not in Egypt, where nobody knows her from Adam. Here, she can be whoever she wants to be. Jessie unpins her straw hat and sets it on the table beside Archie's. She turns to the young soldier. So, Sergeant Winter, what do you do when you're back in Adelaide? Chapter 44. Celie, Heather Green, London, February 1916. Celie rubs her forehead and rolls her head from side to side, but a dull throb has taken hold and refuses to dissipate. We are writing to acknowledge receipt of your letter of reapplication to work as a German translator in the Translation Bureau. We are currently sufficiently staffed. We shall keep your letter on file should the situation change in the future. Thank you for your interest. She folds the letter from the War Office Translation Bureau and slides it into the folder with the three other rejection letters. She can pass any German test they give her with flying colours. It's ridiculous not to use a woman's skill simply because of her sex. She slams the drawer shut and bites her lower lip, squashing the tears that threaten to erupt. She misses Max so much. If only she could hear from him. Why did this stupid war have to happen? She picks up the reflex camera and turns it over in her hands. She misses the suffragist meetings and marches as well, but understands why Mrs. Fawcett and Mrs. Pankhurst have turned their attention to funding hospitals and encouraging women to work. But writing and distributing flyers isn't the same as marching for the vote. Perhaps she'll head uptown on the omnibus. She's had an idea for an article on women in transport for the Daily Mirror. They'd loved her photographs of the Women's Right to Serve rally and the speculative piece on spiritualistic quacks in wartime about the mediums and palmists preying on worried wives and mothers. "Give me anything about women," the features editor, Mr. Grayson, had said when she'd met him in his office. "Knitting for the soldiers, things like that. The advertisers love that. Royal Vinolia Face Cream signed up for a month of advertisements after that quack piece. They said sales went through the roof. Keep them coming. No one needs to know you're a woman." No one needs to know she's a woman. But they do. Absolutely they do. She hears her mother's heels click on the wooden floor of the hallway. A knock on her door. "Cecilia, I want to talk to you." Celie opens the door. Her mother holds a note and looks particularly out of sorts this morning. "Yes, Mama?" "Do you know anything about Millie's resignation?" "Millie's resigned." "Yes. I found this note by the teapot. She's left to join Royal Woolwich Arsenal as a munitions worker.
A munitions worker, Cecilia?
I can think of only one place where she's heard of such nonsense. Why would any sensible young girl leave perfectly adequate domestic employment to make ammunition? It's hardly women's work.
Mama, everything is women's work now. The war's changed everything.
Well, this has certainly inconvenienced me. Where am I meant to find a maid of all work now?
No doubt, if you go to the Salvation Army, you'll find someone there.
If I do, she will hardly be young and capable like Millie. She knows exactly how I like the vegetables cooked.
I'm sure we'll manage, Mama. I'll buy some sausages at the butcher's while I'm out and make toad in the hole for supper. Millie taught me. I'll teach you how.
Cecilia, I have never cooked a day in my life, and I don't intend to start now.
Sacrifices, Mama. We all must learn new things.
She grabs her hat from the top of her chest of drawers.
I'm going out for a while. I'll stop by the studio and tell Papa we'll be cooking supper tonight. That should excite him.
Celie finds her father up a stepladder in the photography studio, fixing the pulley system for the blackout sheet covering the skylight.
Heavens, Papa! You should wait to do things like that when I'm here to help you.
She sets down the camera on a bamboo table and hurries over to grab hold of the ladder.
Hello, pet. I thought it would be a simple fix, but it's proved to be rather more complicated. If you hold me steady, I think I can manage it.
He loops the loose rope over the metal pulley and gives it a tug.
There. Perfect.
He smiles down at his daughter. Thank you, my dear. He climbs down the ladder and folds it against the wall.
I've developed your photographs of the damage near St. Paul's Cathedral from the last Zeppelin attack. They're very powerful, Celie. You have an excellent eye.
Those poor people, Papa, killed in their sleep. Children as well. We're not soldiers. Why are they attacking us?
It seems we are all combatants in this war.
The War Office Translation Bureau still won't have me. I received another rejection letter from them today.
I'm sorry, my dear. You would be a great asset to them.
I'm quite certain they keep rejecting me because I'm a woman. Can't they see that society is changing?
Even our Millie has left to become a munitions worker. Mama is beside herself. She blames me for it, but you can hardly blame Millie for wanting to make a real contribution to the war effort. As you say, the world is changing.
I promised to teach Mama how to cook toad in the hole for supper. Gerald laughs.
Did you now?
He pulls aside the curtain to the developing room, and Celie steps inside. Her photographs of the bomb damage in the financial district hang from a string like bunting. She unclips a photograph. The entire facade of a building has collapsed into a mound of smashed bricks and charred wood. And three young boys play on the debris, like it is a dune on a holiday beach.
You should bring that into the Daily Mirror next time you go, pet.
I don't know, Papa. They want articles about women doing domestic things. Apparently, those sell more face cream.
There's nothing wrong with articles about women. It makes a refreshing change from all the news from France.
Yes, well, my next assignment is about how to curl your hair using torn sheets. I can't face writing it at the moment, so I'm off to the West End to take photographs of conductorettes. I'm going to write a piece on women in transport and see if I can sneak it past the editor.
I'm glad to see you're keeping busy.
Celie clips the photograph back on the string.
I have to, Papa. If I'm not busy, I get upset.
She looks over at her father.
You're not cross that Max is German, are you?
It is a complication, Celie, but he seemed like a very nice young man when he came to your birthday dinner. He makes you happy, and that's all a father wants.
Jessie doesn't approve. She told me as much before she left for Egypt.
Jessie has seen some terrible things in the hospital.
No doubt it's difficult for her to be objective.
I suppose so, but what she said was very upsetting. Max is the love of my life, Papa, and I don't even know if he's alive. I have to keep busy, or I'll just...
She chokes back a sob. Gerald encircles Celie in an awkward hug. He pats her back, the wool of her coat damp under his palm from the rain.
You'll be fine, Celie. You're strong, just like your mother.
She leans into her father's embrace. If only it were true. She may appear calm and capable, but her heart is sick with longing for her lost Max.
Chapter 45. Etta, Capri, Italy, February 1916. Etta slides her fingers over the bumps of the grey stones that protrude from the grotto's ruined walls. A film of sandy dust collects on her fingertips, and she wipes her hand on her navy skirt. A gust of cold wind whips across the tops of the umbrella pines on the cliff opposite the grotto's entrance, and Etta pulls her coat collar up against her chin. She blows into her hands and silently chastises herself for forgetting her gloves. She feels better today, which surprises her, given the leaden sky and threat of rain. The mimosa tree outside her bedroom window has begun to bloom, and she'd woken to the honey and violet scent of its feathery yellow flowers. Truthfully, when she closes her eyes to sleep each night, she's never sure which side of her personality she will awaken to these days. There are nights when the noises and images in her head make sleep impossible, and she has to resort to Liliana's tonic of laudanum, honey and wine to lull her into sleep. In the mornings, after those drugged dreams, she awakes with a heavy head and a fuzziness of thought which makes the effort of facing the day almost too much to bear. Then there are the days like today, when she wakes and the confusion and dullness have melted away, when she stretches her arms, relishing the joy of her body's release from the sluggishness of the previous days, when she jumps out of bed and reaches for Adriana, holding her close against her breast as she burrows her face into the baby's silky golden hair, when behind her closed eyes she sees Carlo's face and hears his promise to come back to them. She sits on an ancient stone step and tucks her skirt around her legs against the chill. If only every day could be like today. She opens her cloth bag and takes out a sketchbook and a charcoal pencil. It had been good of Stefania to offer to watch Adriana this morning. It had been some time since she'd felt up to a walk. The villa's thick walls were a refuge from all the uncertainty in the world, from the fear that rose inside her when she thought about Carlo freezing and fighting in the snow of the Italian Dolomites. The walk had been Stefania's idea. She demurred at first, but after a breakfast of strong milky coffee and Liliana's lemon cake on the balcony, where the fresh winter breeze had sloughed off the last vestiges of lethargy, she'd felt ready to face the world outside the villa's walls once again. She bends her head over the sketchbook and is halfway through a sketch of the umbrella pine that stretches over the view across the sea to the Amalfi coast when she hears his voice. Etta! Cara mia! The sketchbook slips from her lap. She leaps to her feet, and Carlo is suddenly in her arms, his body a solid thing, his kisses hot and real, his voice a caress in her ear. Etta, my angel, my darling, I've missed you so much. You are my life, my breath. She looks up into Carlo's dark eyes, which flash with the ardour of his love, above the deep shadows that sit under his eyes like blue crescents. Carlo, my darling! She touches his face with her cold hands, afraid that he is a hallucination. But he is there, solid and warm. I thought you were in the mountains. I've been so worried about you up there in the snow. I can imagine how cold that must be. He takes hold of her hands and blows on them. He rubs them between his own.
I told you I would come back, mio Angelo. I managed to take leave for 10 days. I've been travelling since Sunday to come to you and Adriana. Have you seen her? Did Cousin Stefania tell you where to find me?
Carlo pulls her down onto the step to sit beside him. He hugs her against his rough wool army coat.
I went to the villa straight away. Adriana is beautiful. She has your dark eyes and your name. Adriana Cristina Marinetti. It's on her birth certificate. The priest wanted to see your marriage certificate, but I told him it had been lost in a Zeppelin attack in London. He wasn't happy about it, but Cousin Stefania took him to one side, and he had a change of heart. I believe some lira may have changed hands. I shall make sure to make it right with her before I leave.
Etta brushes her hand along his cheek's rough bristles. He kisses her fingers.
I am sorry, Etta Mia. I had no time to shave since I left the mountains. Your cousin must think I look like a vagabondo.
I don't mind. I'm just so glad you're here. He unpins her hat and sets it on the ground. He kisses her hair and enfolds her in his arms.
My darling, there is something I must tell you.
Etta nestles more deeply into his embrace.
That you've missed me every moment of every day. That mine is the face you imagine when you wake in the morning and the one you dream of when you sleep. That's what you are to me, my darling.
She turns in his arms and reaches for his face.
I love you, Carlo Marinetti.
He kisses her, and the warmth of her body enfolds him until she is the only world he needs, the only world he wants. Until the urgency to tell her about Mariana and Paolo wafts away like a leaf on the February breeze. The following days pass in a blur of Liliana's food, walks along the goat paths in the hills, where the first wildflowers have begun to peek shyly through the damp grass, with Adriana bundled up like a plump doll in Carlo's arms, and love. Endless nights of love, where Etta and Carlo find their way back to each other through the entwining of limbs and ardent caresses of their lovemaking. For Carlo, the days are bittersweet, and on the fourth morning, he knows he cannot delay telling Etta about Mariana and Paolo any longer. After breakfast on the balcony, when Adriana has been whisked off to the kitchen to watch me make bread by a doting Liliana, and Stefania has retired to her room to read, Carlo reaches across the wicker table and takes hold of her hand.
Etta Mia, I love you with all my heart.
She smiles, and to him it is like the sun breaking through clouds on a stormy day.
And I love you, too.
Etta, I must leave today. She drops the needlepoint she is working on into her lap.
Today? But you said you had leave for 10 days.
It will take me 3 days to return. I have no choice.
I thought we had a few more days.
No. Unfortunately.
When will you be back?
I can't say this. As soon as I am able.
I see.
Etta, I must tell you something. It is possible you may think differently of me when I tell you this. You may wish never to see me again.
Whatever are you talking about? How can you say such a thing?
He squeezes her hand. Etta? Etta, I am married. I have a wife and a son. Etta gasps, the pain in her heart worse than any wound a bullet can inflict.
What?
Carlo bounds out of his chair and kneels at Etta's feet. Please, let me explain the situation.
You're married.
The walls of her life crumble around her. My wife, Mariana, is not well. She is in an asylum near Napoli.
She lives in a world of fantasy. She does not know me anymore. She has not known me for many years, not since the birth of our son, Paolo, 13 years ago. You have a 13-year-old son.
I was young, Etamia. I was only 19 and Marianna 18. We were children, playing at life. When she found she was expecting a child, her father insisted we marry. I married her gladly. She and the child were my responsibility, and I loved her. We lived with her parents in their villa in Napoli until the birth. It was a difficult birth. And afterwards, she lost her... How do you say? She lost her hold on the world. She saw ghosts and spectres around her, and she refused to touch Paolo, saying he was the son of the devil. Etta's heart trips and races inside her chest. She could never believe anything as terrible about Adriana, even on her worst days. The doctor said she would emerge from the psychosis over time. It is true, she did improve, and for a time she recognized me and cherished the child. It seemed like we would have a normal life. We lived together in her parents' villa. He glances toward the sea. There was another child. Another child. He takes hold of Etta's hands. Yes. Marianna lost the child. A girl. The psychosis returned. She has never recovered. Etta pulls her hands away. Where's your son? He is at a boarding school in Roma, a very expensive school. It is why I live so poorly. You must have wondered where my money goes. I spend it on Paolo's education and Marianna's place at the asylum. Marianna's father is a rich man, but he refuses to pay one lira. It is his punishment to me for ruining her for a wealthy husband. Etta shivers, but it is not because of the cool winter air. Are Adriana and I another of your mistakes? Carlo grips her arms. No, no, my darling. You are the precious wife of my heart, and Adriana is my beautiful angel. I love you. You must believe me. What if you die up in the mountains? What happens to us then? Carlo rises to his feet and paces the balcony stone tiles like a caged tiger. Don't worry. I shall find a way. But how? I can never be your wife as long as Marianna is alive. If we don't marry, I am nothing more than a mistress. No, you must never say that. Why didn't you tell me this before, Carlo? I was going to, cara mia. But then, when you told me about the baby, I couldn't. What are we going to do? Carlo rests his hand on the cool stone of a pillar and stares out at the ink-blue sea and the grey clouds sitting over the hills of the mainland. I don't know, my love, but I shall find a way. Chapter 46. Christina. Marylebone, London. August 1892. Christina hooks the handle of her parasol over her arm and pushes the baby carriage out the front door of her father's grand Georgian house on Portman Square. The towering plane trees in the square across from the Georgian terrace shimmer in the humidity, and she wipes away a film of dampness under her nose with her hand. She will need to strip down to her shift when she comes back and sponge herself with cold water. Her aunts will make another fuss, of course. Calling away one of the housemaids to carry a bowl of water and a towel to her, disrupting the smooth running of her father's household. Heaven forbid. She's been back in London barely a fortnight, and already she feels that her father's house is no longer her own, now that his spinster sisters, Henrietta and Margaret Bishop, have moved down from the country house in Yorkshire for the summer. Why anyone would choose to stay in London through the suffocating August heat is beyond her comprehension, when the breezes across the Yorkshire moors make for a refreshing summer. If the country house hadn't been closed up, she would escape there with Cecilia, well away from the aunts and their judgmental whisperings about her fall from grace and weak Italian blood. Her aunts are only too happy to remind her at every opportunity of the scandal it would cause if the circumstances around Cecilia's birth reached the newspapers. The well-brought-up daughter of one of London's pre-eminent architects, the mother of an illegitimate child. Her reputation and Cecilia's future would be ruined, and the family name raked through the mud in the London tabloids. How could she have done this to them? To them! That's all they care about. What people would think of them. She refuses to reveal Harry's identity, though even her father has pressured her for it. Why would she? Harry has abandoned her and the baby. Giving me money, like I'm a loose woman. It makes her sick to think about it. She will be happy if she never sees his face or hears his name again while she's on this earth. If only it were that easy. Whenever she looks at her baby, she sees Harry's face. He haunts her dreams, and her betraying heart still quickens at the thought of him. She lives in terror of rounding a street corner to find him there. What would she do? What would he do? Greet her? Walk by as though they had never shared those blissful hours under the blue Italian sky? She would die if that happened, as surely as if he stabbed her in the heart. James Bishop looks across the dining table at his daughter. How much like his own mother she looks. The same auburn hair and blue eyes, the straight-backed, regal posture. It is in ephemeral things that he catches a glimpse of his late wife, Isabella. In the way Christina runs her hand around her ear, the shape of her mouth when she smiles, or the penetrating look when she seems to see all one's hidden thoughts. Isabella had harboured such hopes for their only child since Christina's coming out 2 years before. Despite Christina's beauty and accomplishments at drawing, needlepoint, conversation, and her skill at the piano, the scandal of his own marriage to the daughter of an Italian labourer had shadowed his daughter, and the aristocratic suitors Isabella had dreamt of had kept their distance. Still, there may have been the chance of a marriage to a clever young barrister or physician, or even a young military officer. But this would never happen now. He'd heard the quickly stifled whispers of work colleagues and neighbours since Christina's return from Italy with a baby. For once, he is in agreement with his sisters. Something has to be done to save Christina's and the family's reputation. His elder sister, Henrietta, looking as severe and humourless as a thin Queen Victoria, dabs at her lips with a napkin. "James, you can't avoid this unfortunate situation any longer. It is almost more than Margaret and I can bear to be under the same roof as a woman who..." She sweeps her colourless eyes over Christina, who has sullied our family name in such a base fashion.
"Indeed, James."
Margaret, a plumper and even durer version of Henrietta, interjects.
"The audacity of showing up with a fatherless child in her arms. We are not the Salvation Army. Your marriage to that Italian woman and Christina's birth 7 months later saw our poor parents into an early grave and dragged the bishop name through the mud once. The family cannot survive another scandal. We shall all be ruined."
She glares at Christina.
"Is that what you wish, Christina? To see us all in the workhouse?"
Henrietta gestures for a footman to refill her wineglass. "You certainly do have gall, Christina. You should have done the decent thing and stayed in Italy with your kind." "That's enough, Henrietta." James tosses his napkin onto the table and dismisses the footman with a wave. He looks at his daughter, whose bottom lip trembles, the food on her plate virtually untouched. "Christina, you know, of course, that your refusal to reveal the name of Cecilia's father is extremely vexing to me. It is simply not right that he should be permitted to abscond, leaving you behind with a child in your arms. Stefania claims ignorance, and I must take her at her word. I'm asking you one last time. Who is this man?"
"I can't, Papa. I don't want anything from him."
"Oh, for pity's sake!" James glares at his sister. "That will do, Margaret."
He reaches for the decanter and pours himself a large glass of wine before turning to his daughter. This is what we shall do, Christina. While you were in Italy to study Italian with Stefania, you met, fell in love with and married a distant Italian cousin, a Roberto Innocenti, a young physician. You had a child with your husband. Unfortunately, he was taken ill with a Russian flu from one of his patients and died shortly after Cecilia's birth. You are a widow with a child. Your name is now Mrs. Christina Innocenti. He takes the wine glass and pushes away from the table. This is the last I wish to hear on this subject. Is that clear? I am retiring to my study and do not wish to be disturbed. Christina sits, frozen in her chair. The realities of her year in Capri were to be erased from her life. Her father has killed Harry, as surely as if he had shot him through the heart. Christina opens the parasol over her flower-bedecked hat and takes hold of the pram's pushbar. Already the heat of another August day causes her to reconsider, for a brief instant, her decision to escape the dour interiors which seemed to have absorbed the personalities of her aunts. It had been so different when her mother was alive. Then it had been a home of cheerfulness and hospitality, with her pretty, exuberant mother, Isabella, the celebrated hostess of her father's household. Now, her father stays in his study when he isn't out at work or at his club, emerging only for sad, silent dinners in the grand dining room, his handsome features carved with furrows of sorrow. Despite the enticement of the shade promised by the square's plane trees, Christina turns left onto Baker Street, taking advantage of her aunt's afternoon shopping excursion to Selfridge's, which she, of course, has not been invited to join. Today, she will introduce Cecilia to the green expanses and gardens of Regent's Park. She pushes the pram past the offices and shops that cater to the needs of the wealthy middle classes inhabiting the handsome Marylebone terraced houses. The further she walks from her father's house, the lighter her step. She will buy an ice cream to share with Cecilia and rent a deck chair to listen to the band in the bandstand by the boating lake. They will feed the geese and ducks the bread she's been hiding in her breakfast napkin the past few days. And, possibly, for a brief few hours, she will remember what it feels like to be happy. She passes under the awning of a photography studio and rests for a few minutes in its shade. She peeks under the pram's canopy at her baby, whose blue eyes widen as her tiny pink lips form into a smile. "You're a pretty little thing, aren't you, Cecilia? It won't do you a jot of good, I'll tell you that." She takes a delicate handkerchief out of the pocket of her dress and dabs at her face as she gazes through the shop window, where gold lettering curves across the glass. Frederick J. Fry and Son, Photographers. She catches the eye of a tall, slender man with neatly brilliantine dark hair and a large brown moustache, which she suspects he has grown in order to disguise his youth. He looks away quickly, as if she has caught him with his hand in a biscuit jar. A smile pulls at the corners of her lips. "Cecilia, how would you like to have your photograph taken? We'll give it to Papa for his birthday next month. Isn't that a lovely idea?" A bell tinkles over the door as she enters, pushing the carriage. The young man hurries from behind the counter and holds open the door. Christina rewards him with a smile. "Thank you." "You're most welcome, madam." He moves around the baby carriage as awkwardly as a boy who has grown 6 inches in a summer, his arms and legs not quite at ease in his tall frame. "How may I be of assistance?" "I should like our photograph taken. My daughter is 3.5 months old today, and I should like to mark the occasion." The young man's blue-grey eyes light up. "What a momentous occasion indeed. I shall be delighted to oblige." Christina folds down the canopy and lifts Cecilia into her arms.
The baby's lace-capped head bobs as she looks around the room. She settles her blue gaze on the man and reaches out to touch his moustache, giggling with delight as her fingers close around the bristles. Christina grabs hold of Cecilia's hand. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Naughty girl. Oh, no. Don't worry at all. Her grandpapa has a moustache. She's quite fascinated by them. The young man brushes his fingers self-consciously over his whiskers. I'm quite flattered, then. Her father didn't have one. He passed away just after she was born. The flu. The man's smile fades. I'm terribly sorry. The flu has been such an awful thing. He holds out his hand. I'm Gerald Fry. He points to the gilded lettering on the window. I'm the son in Frederick J. Fry and Son. Christina slips her gloved hand into his. It's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Fry. I'm Mrs. Innocenti. Christina Innocenti. She jiggles her daughter in her arms. This is Cecilia. Gerald smiles down at the baby. Hello, Cecilia. It's very nice to meet you. He gestures toward a green velvet curtain which hangs over a doorway. The studio is just through there, Mrs. Innocenti. I shall do my very best for you and Cecilia. I'll be sure to develop the photograph directly and put it in a nice frame so that you may collect it tomorrow. Please, after you.